This is Saturday at the Freiburg Assembly. I have no idea what the date is, but this is the second lecture.
Seventh.
August 7th. My name is Ken Turley, and the title of my talk is Over Hill and Dale, A Look at Mountains and Valleys, Highs and Lows, and Inner and Outer. I'm sorry to have missed most of the lectures here. I would have really appreciated all the background information. I would know clearer what you've heard and what you haven't, but I'm just going to risk being a little redundant and talk about hills and valleys. I'd like to begin just reading a couple things to set the groundwork. Oh, dear. In the Bible, hills correspond to the church, where there is love toward the neighbor. By hills is signified love toward the neighbor. The reason is that angels who are in love toward the neighbor dwell upon hills. When in place of love towards the neighbor, there reigns the love of the world, the hills are said to melt. Also, upon the high hills corresponds to the adulteration of good and the falsification of truth. They had worship in groves and upon hills, and because hills signifies the goods of charity, in which are the spiritual angels who dwell upon the hills. Hence, in ancient times, worship was performed upon hills. But this was forbidden to the Jewish and Israelitish nations, lest they should profane the holy things which were represented. And then one last thing. The spiritual kingdom should come above the good of charity, even to the good of mutual love, which is of the celestial kingdom, and thus that these two kingdoms should be inmostly joined. Now that's about hills, and as you see here, hills is about the good of charity, but it can also be its opposite, it's profaned. Valleys refer to the state of the external person as to good and truth at the time. The Valley of the Kings corresponds to the truths of the external man. The external man is called a valley from the fact that it is below, for that is which is exterior and also lower. So, one of the things that I learned in doing this is that valleys and hills and mountains are all about people and their state. The valley is the lowest, which is not a value judgment so much, but it is the most external. And hills are higher than valleys and more inward than valleys, but they're lower than mountains and more exterior than mountains. Mountains then, of course, being the highest and most inward sense. Mountains are the closest to God in a geological sense, closest to the heavens. And in spite of the prohibition against the Jews creating temples up there to worship God, it's something that they seem to do quite often. The hills, again, not quite so lofty as the mountains, but again, very much a sense of raising, elevating one's awareness and in a closer relationship to God. And then the valleys, the lower external aspect of human life. And again, it was my sense going into this that the valleys were the evil places and the peaks of the mountains were the holy places. And while in some sense that might be true, the fact is that all levels of human activity can either be good and holy, or they can be evil and perverted. And even the valleys have their good uses. So, just a couple of things from Scripture to think about as we go through this little exploration today. Thinking about Moses and his activities, you know, one of the most important figures of the Old Testament, who was really involved in a transformational process that the Israelites were going through, taking them from Egypt and what at one time was a good thing, but had come to a point of being enslaved by that once good thing. Moses led them out of that through the wanderings into the wilderness to the Holy Land, which was at least one stage of the fulfillment of the original covenant that God made with Abraham. And I was thinking about the Red Sea, which is a valley right down there at sea level, and Mount Sinai. The Red Sea is where they escaped from the Egyptians. In a sense, it was a confrontation with evil through God's help. Right there at the ground level, they managed to step out of Egypt and leave the Egyptian enslavement behind them. It was a moment of transformation. Life for the Israelites before that moment was one thing, and life for the Israelites after that moment was something entirely different. Before, they had all they needed to eat, they had houses, they had relative comfort, yet they were also enslaved and forced to labor and suffered under that. After that moment, they were no longer slaves, they were free, they were no longer oppressed by the Egyptians, but as the singer said, freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. They had freedom and they had nothing else. They were hungry. They slept out in the desert. They had no protection from anything. They had one thing going for them, and that was the presence and the promise of God. So here we have at the valley an incredible event, a moment of transformation, a confrontation with the world, a confrontation with all of the things, all of the evils of the world, and a breaking free of that, a huge step in the process of regeneration that the biblical story represents. Then we have Mount Sinai. I don't know if it's the biggest peak in the Holy Land, but it's certainly very prominent. A lot of things happened there. Particularly, this is where Moses went up the mountain and had his face-to-face meeting with God, something that's relatively rare in the biblical story. From this meeting with God, this interaction, Moses came down with the Ten Commandments. This too, at the other end of the spectrum, was an incredible moment of transformation. Before that time, people were only guided by their leaders, a general knowledge of what God was about and the commandments that God gave them that were pretty much site-specific. After that moment, they had the law to guide them. They had the Ten Commandments, which were specific prohibitions and encouragements to behavior. This is a dramatic dividing point in the spiritual regeneration process of the Israelites and by extension each one of us. So these two incredibly transformational moments, one in the valley and one at the peak of the mountain. It's also important to remember then that while these kinds of good things happen, Sodom and Gomorrah were also in the valley. The worst of evils were right down there in the valley. And we all know what happened to them. But also, there is continually references to places of worship in the hills. And often, in looking at the correspondence of these, they are representing false worship. My sense of it is that it's a typical human behavior, doing one's best to appear worshipful and reverent and respectful by going through all of the appropriate external motions. We'll make a temple to God and we'll sacrifice all kinds of bulls and calves and doves, and we'll do it up high in the mountains in the hopes that God won't know what we're doing in daily life. So, again, a specific spot on the geographical continuum is not in and of itself an indication of goodness or evil, holiness or profanation. Human beings have the capability of being either at any realm of their life. And also I want to underline the fact that while geographically we're talking about lower and higher, spiritually we're talking about externally and inwardly. And here again, in living, while we think about inwardly as being our spiritual aspect and our place where we get close to God, and external is the way we deal, is our more material, natural level. As human beings, this is a continuum, and both ends of it are essential to our life and our growth as a spiritual person. Because, yes, we're spiritual beings, but we are living in a material realm. And it is in the context of the material realm that we work out and develop who we are as spiritual beings. You take away our body, you take away our ability to live. And it is in the process of living that we develop who we are. So, again, even though the valley or the external is most natural, it is essential to our process as a spiritual being. I'll get into this a little bit more in a bit. All right, I want to talk about a couple New Testament scenarios. Basically, the gospel and Jesus. And starting off with after his 40 days in the wilderness, which the wilderness is full of both valleys and hills and mountains, and Jesus was wandering around out there, we come to his first temptation. And the first temptation, for lack of a better term, the devil, comes to him and challenges his need in a low place. Jesus is weak, he's tired, he's hungry, and the devil comes to him and appeals to this most external things. He says, I'll give you bread, or turn these stones into bread. So there's evil challenging him at the lowest, most external, most material level. Are you willing to misuse your divine power for the sake of your material wants? The second temptation, the devil takes him to a high place and points out all of the material realm around him and says, I'll give you power over all of these things. That's the one where he test him again. Are you going to use your sacred powers, misuse your sacred powers for your own well-being? You know, throw yourself off and get God's angels to save you. Jesus was about living as a human being. And I think part of his ongoing temptation was to refrain from using the divine power which was at his disposal for his own well-being. And here the devil's testing him at the highest, most inward place. And then finally, that temptation of, if you worship me, I'll give you everything you want, which really is a kind of attacking him at all levels at once. It seems to me that a lot of Jesus' ministry, well, I guess the way to look at it is to keep in mind the context of where any given event in Jesus' ministry is taking place. We have the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus goes up on the mountainside, all the people come with him, and he delivers this sermon from the mountainside. Right there, that's telling you that this is a more inward landscape that this event is taking place, where this message is coming from, and to that level to which it's speaking. Yet there are also times when Jesus is right at the shore level, right at sea level, delivering his talk. He goes to cities that are in the lower valleys and Jerusalem, which is set on a hill. So when you're reading the Bible, it's important to keep in mind, what elevation are we at? What level of being are we engaging at? Is this our external material, natural level? Is this our more spiritual inward level? Or is this the most inward level? I also want to point out that Jesus' death on the cross took place on a hill, on Golgotha. So, even for Jesus, the best of things happened on hills, and the worst of things happened on hills. The best of his ministry and some of his most harshest challenges took place in the valleys and the low places of life. I want to share with you my personal experience with this. When we were in England just recently, Reverend Rita Russell took us out to Derbyshire, which is a hilly area. We'd been in Derby, which is relatively flat, and she wanted us to see this, and it truly was beautiful. It looked a lot like Vermont, parts of New Hampshire, the Green Hills. Relatively small, compact hills, truly, truly beautiful. And of course, in England, the one thing that was dramatic to me was there are very few expanses of forest. As you're riding through the countryside, every bit of useful space is either wheat fields or grazing for sheep and cattle. And particularly as we got into the hills, there were sheep everywhere. All the sides of the hills were just dotted with flocks of sheep and little fences, and it was truly picturesque. As we were driving in, we could see them from a distance, and we entered in the softer hills, and then we kind of came over the top of this hill, and there, sticking up, was a very dramatic. It looked like a miniature mountain. It was to the point where you could call it a mountain. It wasn't anything that we would call here on the East Coast a mountain. It wasn't like anything like Mount Washington, but it was just so sharp and dramatic looking. So, one of the dynamics of these hills is a sense of invitation and challenge. I was sitting in the front seat. Ethan was in the back seat. As soon as we saw it, the first thing out of his mouth was, "I want to climb that." And I must confess that I had the same response. Wouldn't it be cool to get up on top of that? So this place that's up, that's inward, that's close to God, conveys a message of invitation and challenge. Are you able to get up here? Which we set about doing. So it was interesting. Being at the bottom and looking up really struck me as being in a state of repentance. This is where I'm at, and that is where I want to be. To me, that is the definition of repentance. It's not so much about feeling sorry for yourself or feeling guilty or feeling bad about yourself. That may be a dynamic, but it doesn't have to be about negativity. To set a goal for yourself, even to say, "Hey, I'm pretty good right now, but I want to be better," or that is repentance as well. And standing at the foot of that hill and looking up, I definitely got the sense of repentance in that I'm in this state now and I want to be up there. And it's going to be some hard, painful work to get there. So we set about the climb. And just as in the process of spiritual growth, people take different approaches, so too with our physical climb up the mountain. Ethan, being the young buck that he is, took the direct, aggressive approach and started straight up. I took a different approach myself. And I took the more intermittent but persistent approach, where I didn't go straight up the hill as fast as I could go, but I did take a pretty straight tack. I did zigzag around, but most importantly is I climbed and I rested. I climbed and I rested. And the climbing was vigorous and exhilarating, and the moments of rest were very welcome. But I took those pauses to look around, to take my view off the peak and look around me, and also to turn and look out to see where I was and what I could see from where I am. In our process of spiritual regeneration, I think that that's an important dynamic, that we need to work hard and we need to struggle with the challenge in front of us, but to take moments to just back off and sort of take stock of where we're at, regain ourselves, catch your spiritual breath, so to speak. It makes the process of getting from the depth to the height something that doesn't kill you, to put it frankly. There's another process or another approach to the process of spiritual regeneration, and that is the regular and gradual. Going straight up that peak, which, by the way, to give you, could actually have your feet on the ground and put your hands on the side of the hill and climb up in spots. It was that steep. If any of you have ever done that, you know that's extremely strenuous. But there were sheep all over the sides of the hill, and there were also little trails. And sheep are, if you haven't noticed, are basically lazy animals. They like it nice and quiet and peaceful. And they will seek out the path of least resistance. And there were all these little trails, very subtle, but places where you could get your feet on something almost flat and walk long zigzags back and forth across the face of the hill. And by doing this, it took a lot longer, and it was much slower in process, but you could make your way to the top in such a way that it was nowhere near as strenuous as either my way and certainly Ethan's way. And yet, I think Laurie and Emily took more of that approach to it. But the fact is, we all of us ended up at the top. Now, before I go there, I want to take just a little sidestep, and that's to talk about sheep. Sheep, as we know, represent our more good affections. Affections of good, affections for good, affections from good. Sheep are domestic animals. They're within the fold. They respond to the shepherd. They're gentle and peaceful, and they provide us food and clothing. Well, when you think about a hill, the valley and the hill and the space between them, and these sheep grazing on there, when you think about that correspondentially, I found it fascinating, because as we were climbing up, you know, we could get from me to Dorothea to the sheep, and they would, you know, watch us, and if ever we made any kind of motion, they would scamper away till they felt comfortable. But they were eating grass all along the side of the hill. And the other thing is, you had to pretty much watch where you were putting your feet, or you would step in the result of them eating the grass. But what had occurred to me was that the sheep are an essential part. There was a kind of homeostasis happening on this hillside, that the sheep were eating the grass and they were pooping their poop, and that became the fertilizer for the grass, and the grass would come out nice and green, the sheep would eat it, and it was a real homeostasis. All parts of the cycle fed another part of the cycle. And that when you step back from this whole thing, you had this unbelievably beautiful image of this dramatic peak, green and rich and verdant, and the sheep, just peaceful and lovely. And it was like the definition of life, or what life should be. The highs and the lows, and life living it, doing its thing, if you'll pardon that lame expression. Yet everything was taken care of. There was water, a river down in the bottom. There was life happening the way it should be. It was like a little slice of heaven. And that the sheep representing these good affections were the very thing that created the loveliness to the dramaticness of the hill. And I just got this sense of how important it is to nurture our good affections. They serve maybe some lofty or noble, useful purpose, but just their presence in the landscape of our life add a sense of quiet, peaceful beauty and add to the lushness and verdancy of the dramatic changes that we go through. All right. Getting to the top. Reaching the summit was an amazing feeling. It was an amazing view. There was a sense of exhilaration and peace all at one time. When we got to the top, we could see all the way around, 360 degrees. I mean, there were other hills and peaks which kept us seeing from long distances, but then there were valleys and sort of notches where you could see for miles. There was a great sense of accomplishment, because I wasn't at all sure, standing at the bottom, that I would make it to the top. But we did, and there was a real sense of accomplishment there. There was a sense of being close to God. You're high up, you're looking down, villages in the distance, There's this sense of being elevated and the sky up there and seeing a bird fly below you. It's an amazing feeling. So, and at least for me, it was a journey I made by myself, that I got there and there was a sense can't think of it now, but when you set out to do something on your own and you do it, it was not a lonely feeling. There was just this sense of internal peace about being there. Lori and Emily kind of climbed together, and I think maybe their experience of reaching the top might have had different dynamics to it. I know that when I got to the top, Ethan was already there sitting, and when I went to greet him, in a polite way, he let me know he didn't want any company. He was just soaking in that experience of being there on his own. The dramatic thing about it was the peak was extremely small. The top of this mountain was kind of a ridge, and it was no more wider than this. It's not someplace you could live comfortably. Matter of fact, when we came up over the top, there was immediately right back down. And if you have any discomfort with heights, it was you were worried about falling off either side. On the one hand, it kind of brought about a meditative state. You could sit there and just view the world, relate to God, enjoy the sense of peace within. On the other hand, it was a sense of inspiration. It was truly dramatic, looking down the slopes where you had just come from, seeing the people down there, being so close to heaven. And it gave you a whole new perspective on life. I mean, before we'd been down in the valley, now at the peak, you saw the world from a completely different place. In spite of the prohibition, I can understand the impulse to want to build an altar to God up on the peak. It seems to be, we humans just have this insatiable desire to physicalize our spiritual experience. And the temptation to stack up some rocks, and I didn't go so far as trying to catch a sheep to sacrifice, but to do something, to make something, to physicalize the spiritual experience was a real temptation. And you can understand why the Hebrews would build an altar up on top of the hill. And you can understand also why God would not want us to do that. Let it be enough to experience it spiritually. And let what you do, if you're going to build something or do something, do it inwardly and spiritually. Don't dilute the impulse in some physical pile of rocks, even from the best of intentions. The other rather dramatic and ironic realization I had was, as wonderful as it felt to be on the peak, and the inspirational feeling, it's the kind of place where you make a New Year's resolution. You know, I'm going to start getting more exercise. This was great. I mean, all kinds of things go through your mind. But I turned around and realized nothing of use is going to take place until I go back down the mountain to where we live. If you want to do anything, if you want to get anywhere with what you've drawn from the experience at the peak of the mountain, you have to go back down. You've got to come back down to earth, so to speak. In fact, you've got to go right back to where you were before. But the difference is you go back to that place with a new perspective. Even though you're not at the top of the mountain and can't see any longer, down in the valleys, you can see, you see the sides of the mountain and some sky up on top. But even being down there, you take with you the memory of the perspective you had up on top. So as far as finding your way, you are oriented in relation to the big picture of life. This is what our worship is intended to do. When we go to church, when we do something intentionally trying to have a spiritual experience, and we do, we have to come out of that very specific place and come back to earth, come back to where we were, but then begin or resume our journey with the memory of what we saw, what we experienced, what we learned, what changed within us in that high place. And then when we resume our journey, we resume it transformed with new insights, new resolution about where we were going to go from here. It may even be with a sense of we are now going to change our direction as a result of what we experienced on the peak. You come down with a greater understanding of where you are in relation to the world and how to proceed to get where you want to go, which of course depends on your goal, your chosen destination in life. And all of us have different destinations. So after experiencing the peak, coming back down to the valley, where you go from there depends on what you love and where you want to get to. Luckily for the Turleys, it was back in the car and home to the hotel. Let's see. 1, 2, 3. All right. Yes. Just in conclusion here, leave a few minutes for talking. I want to leave you encouraging you to read the Bible and to go through life paying attention to correspondence. It's not just something academic. Swedenborg says all the time in heaven, when angels hear the word read, they don't think about the literal level. They think about the correspondences. And this is something that we can cultivate within ourselves. That when you see a hillside with a bunch of sheep on it, we can think, good and holy affections. When we see a fire, we can think of passion. And is this passion being used wisely for a useful purpose? Or is it out of control in danger of causing destruction or hurting somebody? When we pour a glass of water, a new idea, some truth, or is this really a falsity, something that's going to distort our perceptions or cause us problems? Look at the Bible, look at life with a growing awareness of correspondence and a growing awareness of where you are in the moment and where you're trying to get to. Have a sense of vision and goal and purpose for your life. Remember, life is full of highs and lows. The Holy Land is full of highs and lows. The biblical story is full of mountains and valleys and hills. That mountains are often places of worship, acts of sacrifice, points of life transformation, spiritual transcendence, insight and perspective. That valleys, even though they might be considered the lower external and somehow less spiritual, nonetheless, that's where in our lives the rubber meets the road. That's where we engage life. And that is the true testing ground of what we really are. In the peaks, we have visions about what we want to be. It's engaging life down in the dirty, smoky valleys where we find out who we really are now. I guess I'll leave you with one last image. Going to the book of Revelation, when it comes to the vision of heaven, it's not about mountains or valleys or hills. It's about the city. It is a community of people. It's ascend or descending from heaven onto earth. But there were no hills to go up and worship on. In fact, there weren't even any churches. Life in heaven and heavenly life is not about places of worship that are high or low. Heavenly life is about states of being that are forever worshipful. And I'll close there. Any questions or comments?
At one point, you mentioned the Lord being crucified on Golgotha, and could you say more about the, each correspondence has its opposite. Could you say more about the correspondence of that hill, the hill of the skull, and other hills that may be similar as being the opposite of the good correspondence?
Well, being a hill, it's an elevated, more inward state, and it was where all of the lusts for power and the fear that was enlivened by the presence of Jesus did its best to destroy goodness. I mean, we can talk about, well, I guess I'm fairly limited about talking about what that meant in terms of the Lord's life. But here again, it was a moment of transformation. It was probably the most painful, the most dramatic moment of destruction in terms of the Lord's external life and his being as a physical human being. But it was the point from which his glorification truly began to happen, at least the final stage of it. And as far as the crucifixion part of it, again, it gets at what I was trying to say, is that while we are spiritual beings and that's where all our ideals and our lofty visions and goals are, it is engaging the material world that we find out what we're really made of and who we really are. And it, even our painful experiences, our moments of loss and destruction are part of the growth process. It may be even a more integral part of the growth process than those moments of peace and joy up in the clouds.
Thank you, Ken. Early on, you spoke of the relationship between higher, lower, and inner and outer. And one of the ways center. And as you were talking, that suddenly struck me, it happened before, look at a contour map.
And
peak that you're headed for is really a center. And
that's right.
The lower levels are around it. And the opposite of that would be a pit. The valley, we don't have very many pits, we have a lot of valleys. And the opposite of that is a ridge.
Yeah.
And just my mind just started thinking along those terms on the way in which I think it says if you are wrongly centered, then the center of your life is the external, and the internal is marginalized, pushed out to the sides. And if you're properly centered, then the core is spiritual, and the rest is dependent.
Is dependent on that. I keep losing the mic. Yeah. It just started all of this running, but I particularly appreciated the in order to understand a correspondence quote, I think you have to do exactly what you're doing, that is feel it, be in it, and something in you answers to that physical situation, and that's what correspondence is about for me. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
It's so neat to think about this stuff and just realize how embedded in our language and our culture these correspondences are. I mean, every little child knows that God is up or in their heart. We were talking about in the other day, and that you get down to work. And, you know, it's hard to even think of God as being either all, you know, you kind of have choices, all present in or up. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just so much a part of us in our language and our culture. And we were talking about different religions and different cultures, and I wonder whether some of other religions, you know, share that with us, or if there are differences in the way that they approach the Lord and how it reflects in their language too.
Back to Dave's question, as Ken was talking, it was striking me that the same event or the same object can have opposite meanings for different people. Certainly for those who were crucifying Jesus, the hill had a negative meaning in that there was destruction taking place, and yet before Jesus went to his crucifixion, he spoke of it as something he was going to accomplish in Jerusalem, and he also said, if I am lifted up, I will draw people to me. And he said, there is no greater love that anyone has than that he lays down his life for his friends. And that took place in that hill as well.
And even in their attempt to destroy Jesus, contrary to their attempt, they lifted him up and, in a sense, contributed to what he was attempting to accomplish.
On that same subject in the same place, we shouldn't forget that some good things happened on the top of that hill that day when Jesus turned to one of the criminals that was with him and said, this day you shall be with me in paradise. Aside on your general description of the hikes and the hills and mountains, of course, I too have had those experiences, and they are truly spiritual experiences. And I can remember many times in which the more difficult the climb, actually in some respects the easier it is. And I refer now to true mountaineering when you get into rock climbing, the rather vertical cliffs that I've had the pleasure of attending in the West. You do, because of the fact you're dealing with a pair of people on a rope, one person is resting while the other is climbing. And that is an automatic and requirement of that. And it seems that the more difficult the climb, the more pleasure it is, and I think the more deeper the spiritual experience is. The most, I think, deepest spiritual experience that I have had in the mountains is when I've been involved in technical rescue work. When someone is hurt and they have to be rescued, in some way, the more intense the situation is, the more one has a tendency to totally forget self. I can remember cases where I did things that I kind of surprised me afterwards that I did myself, because I totally forgot about myself. The intent was to get to the person that needed help.
Mm-hmm.
And that even adds to the spiritual experience that you get. I've been there, done that.
Well,
understand.
I'm reminded of that saying, you know, if you're having a hard time in life, you're depressed or something, go out and help somebody else. Get your mind off yourself, and then you benefit from that experience. The other thing, George said popped into my mind. How many of you have experienced going to church or having a spiritual experience and making some sort of commitment to yourself, or you're really clear about it, and then you kind of come down from that and you sort of lose track of what you were and were thinking, and it kind of dissipates? And I was reminded that it's easy to find your way to the top of the mountain. You just keep going up and eventually you end up at the top. But on your way down, that's when you're most in danger of getting lost, because it just goes out infinitely. And if you don't stay clear, stay oriented and committed to your goal, it's easy to lose track of where you are and where you're trying to get to. All right, thank you very much.